What's next on our...
We're going to close out side one with a Feel On Baby.
Reggae song. This is, had they done reggae on a record since Black and Blue at this point? They didn't really do any on Some Girls. There's some sort of reggae-ish, reggae-esque numbers on Emotional Rescue that are reggae flavored, I guess. There really wasn't on Tattoo You, but that was mining the vaults for outtakes and things.
I think this is, sometimes they're saying, well, we kind of combined reggae with a 50 song or something on some other track, but this one, they're just deep. Completely in it. First, you know, there's like this thing, right? There's this cliche of rock writing when you're writing about some other band, you know, X classic rock band, quote, embraced reggae more than any of their peers. And usually that's because they did like one reggae cover or reggae-ish song once ever.
Right.
I might be pointing at you, Led Zeppelin or Eric Clapton. Compared to the Stones, did that band record an album at the historic studio that Jimmy Cliff's The Harder They Come soundtrack was recorded at? Did they actually move to Jamaica ever? When they got their own record company, did they sign one of the original Wailers to that label and give him the opening slot on the largest tour the world had ever seen? Did they hire Robbie Shakespeare on bass and Sly Dunbar on drums for this album? You know, it just goes on and on. And with the Stones, there's a long history of this, but we're very much not talking about an appropriation so much as an immersion that's happened over, I don't know, by this time they've been in it almost like 13 years. This is like the graduation ceremony. This is like, here's everything we've learned about that. Now, reggae, in the UK, that kind of becomes like the next form for black music after soul. Where in the US, we had this whole new soul with Al Green and the Sound of Philadelphia and stuff. And then we sort of had funk, you know, coming in. And these were sort of the gaps filling in the spot between soul and hip-hop coming up. The thing I want to add, that someone has brought this up. You know, Sly Dunbar is playing these electronic Simmons drums, which are another, before you do this eye roll and go, oh my God, what's more 80s than that? You know, right? But this is very dub. If dub being like the electronic music that grows out of reggae, that's very part of that tradition. You know, reggae itself is also very influenced by American soul, just like the Stones. That's a huge influence. Before Bob Marley had dreads, he wanted to be Marvin Gaye, and who wouldn't? You know, Sly Dunbar was hugely influenced by the Stax and High Records drummer Al Jackson Jr., and so should you be, in fact. And of course, Bill Wyman, very influenced by their bass player, Donald Duck Dunn. So it's all coming around.
Yeah.
Everyone here is influenced by someone who's influenced by someone else.
I think every so often reggae or something reggae flavored rears its head up on the American pop charts, maybe every, you know, decade or so. I mean, right around that time, I think Eddie Grant was this around the time of like Electric Avenue.
I want to think that's coming up in a year.
Yeah. I remember Bill Wyman in a interview or one saying that he was trying to get them to sign Eddie Grant as well to their record label or something. And they're like, well, we already have Peter Tosh. We can't have
how many
reggae guys can we have or something? And Peter Tosh and Mick did a duet on Saturday Night Live. I think Peter Tosh was the actual musical guest and maybe Mick walked on or something. One thing I wanted to say about this was this to me is very groove heavy. And I wonder later when they do Voodoo Lounge, Mick had a complaint. He's like, well, we wanted to do these African things and maybe Caribbean things and groove things. And, you know, we got steered away from that, which I think was a mistake. I think if they've been able to do it, would it be something like this?
Would they have had a whole album of this?
Yeah. And some people would say, well, that's not what I want from the Rolling Stones. I want groove, you know, them just grooving. I'm like, well, why wouldn't we want this if anyone's going to do that?
Keith has been saying this. He's like, you know, Mick was just trying to outdance everyone on this record. But the thing that's interesting is he's throwing so many different kinds of dance music into it that it kind of doesn't suffer from that in the way it might have. But in another way, like this song, it's indisputably, it's a dub reggae masterpiece. This is never performed live, unfortunately. But when we talk about this being experimental, this is truly experimental. You can hear Mick, he's blowing Chicago harp, like kind of like Little Walter meets King Tubby in this thing where you've got these incredible echoes and the dub treatment on it and stuff. And it just comes out as something like, wow, I haven't really heard that before. It all meshes together perfect. It's this great thing. And you can't really listen to this and not move. If you're sitting in your chair, you're going to kind of wiggle and move around. Somewhere there is a version with Bill Wyman on bass of this, although I haven't been able to confirm this or find such a thing.
I'd like to hear that. I think he'd add an additional flavor to this that, I mean, it's already really good. That can only, you know, now we're talking A to A plus as a groove tune. I think it's interesting now to look back. So we started the album with Undercover, which is this political protest song done as a rock song with, you know, an additional tack on of these, you know, drum beats and things.
Caribbean drums. It's
right.
Kind of a...
Then we go from there to this 50s Chuck Berry style rocker, which again could easily have taken, you know, come on any of their 70s records. From there we went to this sort of Lowell Fulson meets 80s big drum meets seedy underbelly song. Then we went to Keith to do expensive wino style mixed with Lennon McCartney rocker, and now we end up with this sort of swampy reggae song. Again, you know, maybe a distant cousin to like Dancing with Mr. D or something like that. I'd love to hear this live. I would have loved to hear this.
Do you hear us, fellas? This is, yeah. You know, Chuck Lavelle, start working on it.
Although I wonder if I would have liked to have heard this live, like in the looser 80s era. You know, by the time they do live shows again in 89, like it's very professional, and it's very professional to this day. And it's a terrific show, but it's also a very different show. I'm just worried that, you know, too much of it would be some sort of synthesized, it's like one guy pressing a button in the back to make some of these like outrageous sounds and things that you hear in the background. But I'm still waiting to hear it.
Right.
Let me be wrong, you know, but
let's get started and see. So that's it. That's side one. And we're going to open side two with Too Much Blood.
Yeah, now this is crazy. Now this is a song that... This might be the most danceable, just straight up danceable song on the record. And I think there were a couple of different like dance mixes of this. I've heard versions that have even more horns in them, which are terrific. It makes it almost like a Kool and the Gang song. There's actually, I think, another song we're going to talk about in a little bit here has similar things. But this is one that I couldn't find anything, even begrudgingly, where like any knowledge of Keith liking this song or having much to say about it. I think it's... You know, if there is a song maybe influenced by things like Thriller or Michael Jackson's sound at the time, maybe this is the one. I'm seeing this retrospectively, but let's say I'm there in 1983 in real time, you know, knowing kind of what I know today then, I would think that Mick Jagger's solo records would sound a lot like this. I don't think they really do.
This is what I thought Primitive Cool was going to be and then wasn't.
Yeah, or even She's the Boss, they're much more pop songs, and they're all really good. Yeah, this is the direction that it seems like Keith keeps saying, like, well, this is where he wants to pull us, and that they only really do this one.
Well, this is definitely what Mick, you know, this is the direction he's pulling, and it's strange. But when you just listen to the song, it has definitely, this is like some Barbados disco or something. Mick raps, sort of. It's strange, but it is so funky, and it is wild. And the origin of this is Mick's kind of got a little riff or something. He wants to keep it going, and he gets Jim Barber, the guitar tech and sometimes session guy, like, hey, man, could you do like an Andy Summers?
Wow.
And this pains me. It pains me greatly. Mick Jagger trying to be like everyone else. On the face of that, that doesn't even make sense. Because, like, literally everything that guy does is news. Mm. It's the news of today, you know, like... Where's Andy Summers now? You know, it's a puzzle. The idea of this, where we're bringing in like Caribbean disco, the Police, and rap music, like is Mick right? You know, is now that we're combining all of these things in one song, and I think it works on this in this case it works.
When we say rap now, we're not. If you haven't heard this, you should listen to it. But we're not. This isn't some sort of Sugar Hill Gang style. you know, Super Bowl shuffle or something. I think people are afraid or something. This is him really talking.
Well, he says, I'm not a great rapper. I just made it up on the spot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of a free association. He tells the story, which is based on a true story of a Japanese student who killed his girlfriend.
Yeah. So if you're the sort of person who's into, ukuleles and Pinterest and what goes with that, but serial killers, the song tells the tale of Issei Sagawa, the Kobe cannibal, who bizarrely, he was like an exchange student working on his PhD in Paris. And bizarrely, the French, you know, he was like, well, he's just insane. We're going to deport him back to Japan. And France dropped the charges. So the French court documents weren't available to the Japanese authorities. So they're like, well, we can't actually try him here. So we're just going to let him go. Bizarrely, he lived this strange sort of quasi celebrity life as a free person in Japan. And sometimes they would hire him to do, you know, something questionable taste, like restaurant reviews. And he wrote books about his experiences and killing and eating and necrophilia and all of the things that go along with that. It's, you know, kind of a grisly story. And again, this is one of the things where people are like, my God, the new Stones album, it's so gory and hideous. But I think we would say Mick is making a point that there is just too much violence everywhere you go.
A friend of mine was just Japanese. He had a girlfriend in Paris. He had to date her for 6 months. And then eventually, she said yes. You know? Took her to his apartment. Cut off her head. Put the rest of her body in the refrigerator, and her piece by piece. Put her in the refrigerator. Put her in the freezer.
Well, okay, so the video shows a little of this, and there's a story in the video, a storyline where there's a young woman trying to, watching TV, and she's flipping through various channels. She can't get away from the violence on TV, which, you know.
Be it the news or the entertainment.
Yeah, or... I mean, it continues to this day. Nothing's really changed. Finally settles on maybe the Stones and their music video, and then we see at one point or another Mick's being chased by Keith and Ronnie with chainsaws.
You have to say, it's kind of like, well, you look kind of natural there with that chainsaw, Keith.
We see Mick telling his story about the Japanese exchange student. We see, I think, a head in the fridge, a body cut up inside the fridge. So there is that.
Yeah, there's, you know, like blood flowing out of things and stuff. It's a little more horror and oriented. Certainly way more than Undercover the Night or any...
It is and it isn't. I mean, even at that point, there were probably things on, you know, late night or even, you know, cable TV or late night TV after 10 o'clock that were probably more violent than this. What his other rap, I think, between the raps, I should say, or apart from the raps, if you just read the lyrics of the song, it's not a violent song. He's saying there's too much blood and things, but it's not like, say, you had a death metal song or something where later, like rap songs or something, where he's talking about like actually murdering people. In the lyrics, I mean, right. He talks about it there, but like it's yeah, that's not there at all. So if you just heard the song and you even cut some of that rap out, you'd say, well, this isn't, you know, what's so bad about this, really?
We should bring up here, you know, we're talking about, you know, rap in 1983 is still pretty small. We're sort of in a place in between like the Sugar Hill Gang and the Houdini Run DMC next wave that's really going to make it platinum. Raising Hell is like 3 years down the road from this. The Beastie Boys and Houdini have just started releasing like their first stuff. Believe it or not, Malcolm McLaren is listed as one of the major rappers of 1983.
Really?
Yes.
I think Blondie was getting credit for being a rapper at that point for that one song. She did a song with like Fab Five Freddy. We remember him. There's a second rap where Mick references the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And then they, of course, reference that with the scenes in the videos with Keith and Ronnie attacking him with the chainsaws. How much of that, I think, was made up on the spot where he throws in a reference to going to see Jerry Hall? I mean, he's talking about, like, people say to him, is that really true in Texas where you live? Is that really true what happens around there, people? So I'm assuming that's some sort of reference to like going to see Jerry Hall's family in Texas or whatever.
Can you imagine Mick after, you know, a little too much to drink, just starting in on them with that?
It does have one of my favorite pop culture references of his that I don't think get into a lot of songs or whatever, but just his whole bit about wanting, you know, it's too violent for me. I'd like to take my, you know, I'd take the wife to something more romantic, like Officer and a Gentleman or something, you know.
When I go to the movies, you know, I'd like to see something more romantic, you know, like Officer and a Gentleman or something. Something you take the wife to, you know what I mean?
By the end of this, I would say, like, the horns save the song from itself. They give you something to hang on to and keep you from fixating on these different things that are being brought in. And it is a groove and a half. This came out as one of those 12-inch maxi singles, you know, where you would have the extended dance mix and all of that.
In terms of chart success, I don't think this charted very high at the time. This was, if the album came out in late 83, this is the third single. And by, you know, later in 84, they're already moving on to promoting the Rewind compilation and getting ready for Mick's solo album and then into Dirty Work and things. So this is, in terms of single releases and that, this is like probably the last major push off the record, off the album.
I feel like in a way this is ahead of its time. Like in 1988, this probably would have been a big hit.
Yeah, this, not a live, not one they've done live, but I did catch this in Shine a Light. And they're going through song choices, and Scorsese's trying to figure out what songs they're going to do. It's driving him crazy. I don't know how much of that was staged for the movie, but it's fun. And he's got all these different lists of different songs and different scenes and things like that. And I can't remember if it's Mick's list or Martin Scorsese's list on one of them. And this is on there as a potential choice. So I don't know if it's something Martin Scorsese was trying to push him towards. I mean, those lists are pretty long.
Did they just put it on to mess with him?
There's a lot of songs on those lists. So this, you know, there's a lot of choices. How real it is, I'm not sure. I mean, I've never heard of it being rehearsed or anything. But to your point, the horns make it. And so by that point, 89 and on, they've got these big horn sections permanently in place. So this really could come off well, I think, if this is
done today.
If you're listening, yes, now's the time to do it.
I want to have something more on this video. By the time we see this video, Mick is already doing these moves, throwing shapes, you know, on a level that's never really been equaled to this day by anyone but him. And you can also see another cameo of Keith Giacelli Archtop in this video.
Yeah, you can't really. Maybe it's getting back to the Ron Wood thing. Like I was saying, Ron Wood can, I don't know if he necessarily could come up with these things, but he can, you know, certainly play as well as anybody. I mean, and it's not that he can't come up with great original things. It's just he has a different style than, say, like a Mick Taylor or Bill Wyman.
I don't know what anyone could really knock Woody for. I've heard people say, well, he's just so versatile. Like, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But what you see on this album, where so many styles are coming together, even in the same song, he never misses.
Never. He's like James Bond. He hits it every time. No, but the point is, with Mick's dancing is like, well, maybe someone can impersonate Mick, but you couldn't come up with what he does the way he does. It's impossible.
It's startling.
No one's ever done it.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Hard Labor and Money Splashes, the podcast dedicated to the world's greatest rock and roll band, the Rolling Stones. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Email us at hardlabormoneysplashes@gmail.com.